Blog Talk Radio.
Yo, this is Mood Control. Saying you might as well pay attention. You can't afford free
speech.
Mood Control is designed to render funkable ideas brought to you by the makers of Mr. Prolong, better known as Urge Overkill, the pimping of the flame principle.
Oh, but we'll be taken lightly, like a woodpecker with a headache. Cause it's cheaper to funk than it is to pay attention. You dig? A huckabuck! And lo and behold, one talking with Mood Control.
Every kind of beer.
Deprogram. Lightly, like a woodpecker with a headache.
When you take every kind of beer,
the non-profit organization. Anybody that's out there listening, at some point in time, we're going to get to this being American History Month. But until that time, we're going to celebrate our blackness during this Black History Month. So I don't know if anybody out there has done anything special for this month or made any special acknowledgments or anything like that. But I will say this. Go back and study your history. Take a look around. See where you came from so you know where you're going. And on that note, I want to send out a big congratulations to those people who created the film Black Panther. Now, I haven't gotten a chance to see it yet. I was a little too busy over the weekend trying to get my house set up down in West Palm Beach. I'm going to introduce that to you all sometime in the future. You all will be able to come down and share that with me. But that the movie has made records over the weekend. I hear that there's some fantastic history. So this is a way for everybody to go out and celebrate what African Americans have done in this country to make America as great as it has been. Now, I also want to say a very, very heartfelt farewell to one of my close, dearest friends that I grew up with back in the city of Painesville, Ohio. We lost a brother a few weeks ago, Mr. Tierra Enoch, and I just want to send love out to his family and send our prayers out that God may guide you all during this period of loss. Tierra was very special, one of the truest, nicest guys that I've ever met in my life. And if you had been there at his farewell, for those of us who were there, you could tell that Tierra was loved. The funeral home, the church was filled. We got a chance to see our brother off, and I think that all of us are better people for it, being able to unite in such a manner to see one of our family members leave this earth. But he's in a higher place now, riding that motorcycle that he always loves. So, T, this one goes out to you. Bro, I love sharing the life that we had together. I missed you, but you always with us in our spirit. And I have to say, on that note, for me personally, the trip was more than just going back, seeing a friend off through his passage up to heaven. You know, I hadn't been back to my hometown of Painesville, Ohio, since I graduated high school in 1985. I've been some 30 years since I went back to the place that I was born and raised. And let me tell you, for a long time I stayed away. And I stayed away because I always felt like, hey, you know, it's a small town. It's got that small town mentality. I want to go off and do big things. I want to go make something of myself, and I'm not looking back. Well, you know, I learned something during that journey of these 51 years. Just had a birthday this month, by the way, February 5th. So I know you all are saying happy belated birthday, and I thank you all for that. Thank you. But with that being said, when you grow up in a place like Painesville, for me, being small town, I always had big ideas, so I thought I needed to be in big places. When you get out in the real world, life has a way of showing you who's real and who's not, what's real and what's not. And I have to say this, it was probably one of the best experiences that I've had in my life in these 51 years to get a chance to go back to the place where I ran the streets, the place where I hung out with people who I know to this day sincerely have a love for me and who I am as a person. I can't tell you or express the gratitude that I have for the love that Painesville, the city of Painesville, showed me after coming home and being one of theirs. You know, it was a real welcome. You know, I went to my extended family across the street, the Johnsons. As soon as I walked through the door, the mother knew who I was. 30 years, I mean, she reached out, she gave me a hug, and I felt that that was real. That's real love. It's not that love that you get every day when you leave out and you go and people ask you how you're doing, and you know they're not really serious about it. They're just asking you for conversation. I got a chance to see some of my closest friends. I missed a whole lot of you all, but for those who I did get a chance to see, the whole Johnson family, Leon, got a chance to talk to my man Robert, Ronnie Hogan, Carl Booth, Teresa Lane. I'm just shouting y'all out because I know y'all gave me love and I know y'all still support me, and I really appreciate that. Val Jones, Cindy Thompson, Taj Coffee, Daryl Cooter Harris, my man, Darnell Gibson. Got a chance to see Diane Stokely, my man Terrell Dillard. Thank you, bro. We're going to be doing some big things in the future. My little god brother, Sean Johnson, Antoine Guilford. Even got a chance to see my man Gary Balfour, Mike Jernigan, you know, Tierra's best friend, brother. I know right now you're going through it because of the loss of our brother, but just know, man, you still got some brothers out here that support you. So I just want to let you know, man, give us a call anytime you need something. Derek Abney, same thing, brother. I'm proud of you. Proud to see how you held it down at the funeral service, man. That gave me something to smile about when I left. Terry Green, got a chance to see her. Lisa Brown, a whole host of people that I never imagined that I would get a chance to ever see again. Joni Booth, Carl Booth's mother. All the love that she gave me. She gave me my first nickname, which was Incredible Hulk, because I used to play baseball in Little League, and I was one of the biggest kids on the team. I'm still the same size, though. I didn't grow much after that, but I just wanted to take the time out a few minutes on my show to say, you know, there's an old cliche that says it's not where you're from, it's where you're at. But I found out by going back home, if it wasn't for where you're from, you may not be where you're at. So to Painesville, Ohio, all of you folks out there that's listening, that supported me over the years, that had my back, I absolutely love you all. I got a chance to stay at the Steel Mansion. It's become one of my favorite hotels in the country. It's a really unique place. You all need to go check it out. I told them I was going to give them a plug when I got back, so I'm keeping my word. But I'm keeping course with the show. You all heard the music. A lot of people ask me why I use Parliament for my theme music on a show about diversity. Well, that's Painesville, folks. That's how I grew up. Those are the parties, the house parties, that got me several whoopings for being late coming home at night. And you all, some of you all may be in that age group where you know what I'm talking about, but that city made me who I am, and it's a product that's given me this platform to come to you tonight and do the show called Diversity Works. So for those of you who have heard this show before, you know the caliber of guests that we bring on this show. I go out and I find the top extraordinary subject matter experts in their field, just people who are unique. Now, when I say top of the field, don't get me wrong, folks, I'm not talking about some made-up list where people are judging who's the best and who's the worst. I'm talking about people who are solid in their ability and solid in their confidence about what they can do. And tonight is not an exception. Tonight I have with me a gentleman who I got a chance to be introduced by my sister, Michelle Berard, who had me on her show way back before my show kicked off. Michelle, thank you once again for that opportunity. And she introduced me to this gentleman. And as soon as, you know, I heard him and heard his voice in the conversation we had, I was sold. I was just really, really impressed by this man and some of the things that he has done throughout his life. And his name is Mr. Bernard Lee. Mr. Bernard Lee is the oldest of the older son of a career veteran in the United States military. So that's close to my heart because you all know that I'm also in the military. So he's what we call a military brat, if you will. And I know he's not taking that to heart because we joked around about it. But he has written a book about his experience because he grew up as a child of a military family. And we just had some dialogue on the phone the other day about how that upbringing has gotten him to the point of where he is. But just a little about his background, Bernard is a Howard University graduate in D.C., so you know he's a smart guy. That's our black Harvard, so we know he's got something on the brain. He also joined the Army ROTC and pursued his dream of becoming an Army officer. He did his thing. He obtained a private pilot's license, so I'm going to make sure that when I do hit it big, Bernie's going to be my pilot. He's going to fly me where I need to go. He was also awarded a regular Army commission, meaning that he became an officer in the Army Reserves while he was serving. After he graduated from Harvard in 1969, he had a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering. I don't know what it is tonight about my tongue. I can't get these lips to move, but I'm going to catch up. It's been a long weekend. I've been doing a lot of work, y'all, but I'm good. I'm on it. He served a lot of years working for Bell Telephone Systems, Western Electric, AT&T Long Distance Lines, AT&T Headquarters, Lucent Technologies. He's done a little bit of everything. Bernie has also completed a master's degree in education, and he's taught high school classes for 4 years at Somerset Vocational and Technical High School in New Jersey. Throughout his life, Bernie has been an active community programs provider, with recreational and educational opportunities for young people. So he shows an interest in the community and our young stars coming up in the world today. While he was living in Franklin County Township in New Jersey, he also served as a president of the parent support group. It's called En-ROADS. That's in central New Jersey. He was president and treasurer of the Franklin Township Public Library. He was a manager and coach of the Little League baseball team. He coached winter sports. He coached Pop Warner sports. He's done summer recreational track and field. So Bernie is out there spending time with those kids, and that's what we need in the community. However, he's gone much further than that because what he has also done is taken those athletic activities and also translated them in academic activities as well. When I got a chance to talk to Mr. Lee on the phone, he was just getting ready to go in and teach some young kids how to play chess. That's something I don't know how to do, so that's something else Mr. Bernie's going to help me do. He lives in Georgia right now. He has a wife of 41 years. Her name is Edwina Lee, and he spends time working with How Big Is Your Dream? This is a foundation that teaches the advanced and beginning students in after-school programs in STEM. So if you all know what that is, that's science, technology, engineering, and math, and all that good kind of stuff. So we know Bernie is a smart guy. So tonight, I'm going to tap into some of those brain cells, and I want Bernie to bring his story to you as my audience, because you all know that I profess that diversity is much more than demographic categories. It's much more than talking about race, ethnicity, and all that kind of good stuff, because none of those things perform tasks. It's that other 84% of that person, the brain cells, the muscles, those are the things that perform tasks. So without further ado, I'm going to let this man use his brain cell to show you all what diversity really is on this show called Diversity Works. So without further ado, I would like to introduce to you all Mr. Bernard Lee. Bernard, welcome to the show. How you doing?
Well, thank you so much, Gary, and thank Beverly Black for having me on and hosting this show. I'm so glad to be with you. I hear you when you said you had a great experience when you went back to your hometown.
Yes.
However,
absolutely.
As a military brat, I can't make that claim. And there may be a number of other people listening to this program who have parents who've been in the military.
Yes.
I can tell you where I was born, Washington, D.C., and I can tell you where I've lived. But
right.
As claiming a hometown, can't do that as a military brat. I lived wherever my dad was stationed, and he was stationed in a lot of places in 27-plus years.
Wow. Wow. So can you just tell us a couple of the places that you have actually gotten a chance to live, especially if it was abroad outside of the country?
Yes, I can. We lived in Maryland, where I went to grade school. We lived in Georgia when I was in the fifth grade, Texas when I was in the sixth grade, Oklahoma when I was in the seventh grade, Germany, eighth, ninth, and tenth grade, back to Oklahoma, back to Virginia, back to Maryland. So I had I had quite a time. Not only can a military brat not claim usually a hometown, you have a hard time claiming a school, which you could say that's the school I attended, because very often you move in the middle of the year.
Yes.
So I split my sixth grade between Texas and Oklahoma.
Wow. Wow.
But that's a life I did get used to. It's a rich life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a life that many, many young people know because they have uncles, they have aunts, they have a brother, a cousin, a grandparent who's been in the military. And so you know what that means? You're so glad to see them when they're back.
Right. So not only when the parent deploys, and for those of you who've not been in the military, that means you're going overseas somewhere to fight the battles that we have to fight, fighting the wars. So not only does the parents deploy, but in some respects the kids deploy as well. Would you say that's correct?
Yes, that is. Your job as a young person with a parent in the military is to be ready to leave on a moment's notice. You normally get maybe 1 to 2 weeks notice, and then you're gone. So we got used to that routine, and I can tell you that I learned a lot by traveling around the world, and I think that's some of what I'd like to share with our listeners.
You know, that's a great segue, because my next question to you is, tell us who Bernie Lee is. I mean, you've given us a little background on the experience of being a military brat, if you will, and I know we had that discussion, so I can use that terminology. You've had that experience, so tell us a little bit about who you are and how did you get to where you are today?
I am the oldest son of a family of four. I had a brother and two sisters, and we traveled with our dad, who was in the Army. And that was in the 50s and the 60s. I am a quick study, a quick learner. I get adjusted to a new location very, very fast. If some people have trouble with dealing with bullies, I learned very quickly that you pick out the biggest kid you can find. You make sure that you get to know who that person is. You get to understand what they like and don't like. And you get all that out of the way, because you don't have the time to develop enemies. You don't have the time to devote to being an outcast. You have to fit in as soon as you get there. You have to hit the ground running, and your parents expect that.
Mm. So they have an expectation of you, just like they have an expectation of themselves, that you have to adapt quickly in order to survive in your environment.
That's correct.
So
I'll give you a story that we had when we came to Georgia.
Okay.
It's a story about diversity in the military. Now, one thing you know about a military kid, military kids identify with being a group, and it's a
yes.
very tight group.
Absolutely.
They watch each other's back.
Yep.
And so no matter where you go, you can always count on having a guy or a gal who's there who will know somebody from someplace where you came from, who will be willing to accept you for who you are, and because they're a military kid too, will have your back. So I went to – we moved to Georgia when I was in the fifth grade. We moved into a quarters on post, and the quarters had four units. Downstairs below us was an Italian family.
Mm-hmm.
Upstairs in the unit across from us was an Irish family. And down in the corner in the third unit was a Filipino family. And we counted ourselves, because there were kids in every one of those homes, as military kids. So I get up to go with my sister to the bus stop the very first day of school. We get to the bus stop, and I'm looking around, and one of the guys that we've been playing marbles with a couple of days before says, "Hey, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, you know, we're at the bus stop. You know, we come to go to school." He said, "Your bus stop's over there." And I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, and by the way, your bus is leaving." So my sister and I had to run to catch the bus. Well, we got on this bus. It took
wow.
us from the post. It took us through town. It took us out to an area that had cornfields and cotton fields. And then it took us to this great big clearing in the most beautiful brand new school I had ever seen in my life.
Wow.
Really? I went to that school that day, got back on the bus, came back home. Our bus stopped on one corner. Our friend's bus stopped on the other corner. All the kids ran toward each other when we got off the bus, locked hands, and walked back to our barracks. That was the kind of diversity we had in the military.
That is interesting. So, I just have to ask, so after you had that experience, did you look at the young man that told you you were riding a bus, did you look at him differently, or did you just take it that, hey, he gave me the right information, so I got to where I needed to go?
You know, I actually, it was the latter. Mm. What he was telling me was, you're new here, and so you don't know the protocol. This was 1955. The school desegregation suit occurred in 1954. Not all the states, in fact, many of the states hadn't adopted the desegregated schools or integrated schools. And so in Georgia, if you went to school on post, the school was integrated. If you went to school off post, and our elementary school was off post, the schools were not integrated yet.
Wow. Okay. So you didn't take it as though he was telling you, you don't belong here, like we don't want you here. He was telling you from a child's perspective, hey, you're in the wrong place.
He was giving me a heads up, and I'm so glad that he did, because we nearly missed our bus.
Wow.
And that would have been a tragedy for us, even though we were just fifth and fourth graders. My sister was 1 year younger than I was. When you have a problem as a kid in the military, that problem reflects on your parents. Your mom or dad who's in the military may hear about that from their commanding officer. They may have to answer for your misstep. So we were always aware that you don't just represent yourself if you're a military kid. You represent your mom. You represent your dad. You represent your group. You represent your country.
Wow. You know, Bernie, as I'm listening to you, now, my parents weren't military, but they might as well have been military as strict as they were, because I'm going to tell you right now, when I went to basic training, it was easy for me, because there was no drill instructor around that could yell as loud as my mom, and I wouldn't worry about them hitting me. My mom could hit me. But we grew up in that sort of that same mentality where I'm from, in Painesville. We grew up that way, where when you went out, you knew that you were representing your family. And if you did something wrong, trust me, that line of communication was going to get back before you made it home. And if you didn't get two whoopings by the person who caught you first and then your parents, you were going to get two by your parents when you got home. So, you know, for me, I know what that did to me or for me coming up as a professional. But let's talk about that for a second here, because I'm a believer in the way that you raise your children will reflect on them in the workplace. Because whatever you haven't corrected as a child is going to manifest. So what's your take on that?
You're absolutely correct. You know, corporal punishment wasn't the only way that parents discipline us, especially military kids.
Okay.
I had a misstep, if I was 20 minutes late when I promised to get home at a certain time, I could count on scrubbing the bathroom floor, scrubbing the kitchen floor, waxing the hallway, making all the beds for a week, cutting the grass, washing the window panes, you name it, washing the car.
Yeah.
There was a long, long list of you do what I tell you to do, you keep your word. When you don't keep your word, your list of work and your list of things that you have to do gets longer.
Wow.
And I was not the only young person who had to follow that kind of protocol. Most of my friends had the same upbringing, so it taught you to not give your word if you didn't believe you could keep it. And it definitely taught you to keep it when you did, because the consequences weren't just corporal punishment. The consequences were embarrassment for you, sometimes for your parent, and a long list of to-dos.
Right. Okay, so, you know, you have to explain this to me a little bit, or kind of expound on it for our listeners, because they may have a question about how, when you grow up in the South and dealing with some of the things that you've dealt with, because I know for me, in the little town that we lived in, and we didn't realize how special it was at the time, but like I said, as an adult, I certainly realized the benefits of growing up in a diverse environment. How did that affect you being in a place that was so racially divided along color and growing up in the South and having military parents? How did that affect you?
Interestingly, I was insulated from some of that because much of the time we lived on post. And when you lived on post, you lived in quarters that were appropriate for your father's rank and for their the jobs that they did. You live with people who were comparable to your parents. And so in that case, you were all kind of all the same on the block. Now, when you went into town, that was different. I recall being in the seventh grade when they integrated our junior high school. And they did that and this was in Lawton, Oklahoma, at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, which is a very large facility in Lawton, Oklahoma. They decided that they were going to have students from the post go to town for seventh grade through high school. And $525 at that time per student went with each student. And so the town had to decide whether they wanted the money and would integrate their schools or not. The military, in addition to agreeing to integrate the junior high school, they also agreed to integrate the high school, and as a sweetener in Lawton, Oklahoma, the military assisted the town in building a brand new high school called Eisenhower High School.
Okay.
When the schools were integrated, within a few years, the rivalry wasn't those kids who shouldn't be here in our school. The rivalry was between Lawton High School and Eisenhower High School.
Right.
Between the two schools. Now, how did they determine who went to Eisenhower? There was a gate one and a gate two. The gates were, you know, when you go into the base, you go through a gate. They were main thoroughfares from town into the base. If you lived on the west side of Gate 1, you went to Eisenhower. If you lived on the east side of Gate 1, you went to Lawton High School. That's how they determined who went where. So it really, really diffused the race issue in terms in town. And it really made it easier for us to get acclimated to our new environment. They allowed students who were in Douglas High School and middle school, elementary school, they allowed them to opt in. So if your parents wanted you to go to one of the other schools, you could opt in, you could apply, and you could be accepted. So many students from that environment, some of the students from that environment, also chose to come when the military kids from Post went to those schools. So I went to that for 1 year in the seventh grade.
Okay. Now, going through that experience and being insulated, were you aware of the racial tensions outside the gates? And we like to say outside the gates because it's a lot different when you leave the military post or the military base. So were you aware of everything that was going on outside the gates? And were you warned to be careful when you go out and stuff like that?
We were aware, my sister and I. I was told to take care, look out for my sister. My parents talked to me about, watching your manners, following orders, always be aware of what's going on around you. But I had some very interesting examples of being in an environment that I had not been in before. I recall being in a math class, and I recall that, and this is probably still true today, when you come to school before school starts, you sit in the cafeteria and, you wait till the bell rings. Well, I used to sit at the table with most of the kids who came to the school from Douglas Elementary and middle and high school. And I noticed that there was a group of kids that sat at a table called the math table. Well, I was in that math class, and I was a serious student. I really wanted to get to do well in school. So I decided to leave the place that was most comfortable for me in the morning and sit at the math table. Well, I sat down the very first day I did. I had a kid who sat next to me, and, I didn't pay much attention to him. I said hi, and he said hi. He kind of shrugged. He didn't say hi. So we were sharing problems, and if you had an answer to problem number 10, you shared it. If you had an answer to problem number 15, you shared it. We got to problem 20, and nobody had the answer. I had the answer. So I volunteered my answer. The kid next to me said, I wouldn't take a blankety-blank answer from him because he doesn't know what the blankety-blank he's talking about.
Really?
I could have gotten upset. I could have, jumped on the kid and said, who do you think you're talking to? I didn't do any of that.
Okay.
I said, I threw up my hands. I said, hey, this is math. If my answer is wrong, everybody will know it. If my answer is right, hey, and I think it is, then maybe you want to take it. We got to class. The papers were corrected and handed out. The kid who was sat next to me actually in class sat behind me. They passed the papers back. I got my paper. I had 100. I looked at his paper as I passed it back. He had 100. I had learned something. I had learned that a person doesn't have to like you to take an answer that you have. That was really valuable to know.
Wow.
I'd also learned that a number of other people in the class had 100, like my buddy who sat across from me, and so they had no problem whatsoever sharing my answer. It's those kinds of experiences that balance the ones that weren't as pleasant because the learning was important.
And that's so powerful, especially along the lines of diversity and the type, I will say, the brand of diversity that I'm trying to teach to the masses. I'm trying to hit the reset button to get people to rethink what diversity truly is. And that right there is an explanation of how diversity works. One thing you said that was very key is that you don't have to like a person to accept their answer or to utilize an idea that they have. Now, we know in history that that's happened over and over again, where certain groups of people haven't been liked, but yeah, we'll take your ideas in a minute and use them. But what you described is the other side of diversity that often doesn't get discussed, and that is you had value in your own self-worth. So you knew what you were able to accomplish. So you invested, all right, within yourself by putting yourself out there and then making sure that, hey, you know what? You can take it or leave it, but this is what I'm rolling with. Now, I want to ask you, when you did that change the way those kids saw you as a person?
Yes, it did. And okay. It changed right away. I sat at that table for the rest of the term, and I never had another question about an answer that I shared. I never had a problem in that class being accepted as a regular participant. And I believe it was probably because I expected to be able to fit in, and I expected to do the work that was required to be accepted.
Wow.
And that's a key. That's a key. I've heard people talk about sometimes, you know, people who are different have to do 110%, 115%
Absolutely.
Just to be accepted.
Yep.
I have something to share with you about that.
Okay.
If you don't mind being number 5 or number 6 or number 7, if you never want to be number 1, then no, you don't have to do 115%. You don't
That's
have
right.
to do 102. You don't have to do 100.
That's
but
right.
But don't want to lead anybody anywhere. Don't want to be expected for anybody to look at you and consider you to be a significant person who they can trust to get the job done. Because
right.
everybody who's good enough to do 100% and they do it is going to make that grade. And so for me, it was always about making the grade.
Yes.
If you want to compete, you must make the grade. If you don't want to compete, hey, you take what you get.
There you go.
But competition is required when you're asked to demonstrate what you know, what you can do, what talent you have. That's
yes.
competition, and you've
yep.
got to show your best.
Absolutely, and that's life. And I often, I mean, that's a great, great, great way to look at it, because I often tell people about that same phrase, that why would you complain about being better than everybody else? I've been an athlete all my life, and I've never walked out on the field and apologized to my opponent for being better than them. Never. So why would I apologize in life or in the workplace for being better than someone? And if I'm going to be a leader, if I'm going to be number one, I need to be that much better than everybody else. And you have to take your lumps as well as you take your wins. But that's how you perform. And this is what I'm trying to get people to see on this show called Diversity Works, coming to you from www.blogtalkradio.com, Gumbo for the Soul. This is why I'm bringing this show here, because we really need to rethink. How do we get to a place where we can walk in to a work environment and utilize our skill sets to make that organization better? Because I don't want somebody to hire me simply because of my skin color. My skin color is not going to do anything for you. My aptitude, my ability to think, my reasoning, my decision making, those are the things that, because of my skin color being in America and the way I'm looked at, makes a difference. And as a leader, you have to be able to tap into that. And it sounds like that you've taken that approach throughout your life. And I know, you know, looking at your bio and having the conversation that we had the other day, you put some of these things down in ink. You wrote a book, your memoirs. And just tell us a little bit about that book and what made you put that down in ink for people to read.
I wanted to share, thank you. Yes, I wrote a book called A Look Back in Time, memoir of a military kid in the 50s. And I wrote the book to share with my children, my grandchildren, my godchildren, my great-grandchildren, because I wanted them to know some of the history of what it was like to be with my dad traveling around the world and experiencing all the wonderful things that we experienced. The thing that you might note is my background was technology. My background was math and science. So
okay.
why would I write a book? Well, that's the other thing that young people need to understand. You have talents. Sometimes they're physical, sometimes they're mental,
yeah.
but you have to know what they are. I was always good at writing. I won a contest in the eighth grade for writing an essay about Johann von Goethe, the German author and poet. I wrote poetry in high school. I wrote poetry for my college anthologies. I was always good at writing. So I started a book in 1982. I wrote 56 pages.
Uh-huh.
And then I stopped. I wrote them longhand with a pencil and paper.
Right.
And I stopped.
Right.
I did not finish that book till 32 years later. So my first book took 32 years to write. My second book took 3 years to write. You get a little better at it.
Yes, yes. I mean, your journey sounds like mine. It sounds just like mine. I always had a passion or a drive to write a book when I was a young child. I kept saying, I'm going to do it. I started a couple times, threw it away, and this last time I said, you know what? I'm going to make this happen before I retire. And I stayed with it, and I called that book Everything But a Child of God. I've had divorces from that book. I've cussed that book out, but I stayed with it.
Yes. Yeah, that's what you have to do. For anyone who wants to write, there's a rather simple formula. You do an outline.
Yes.
It's a simple outline. You list all the stories you'd like to tell.
Yep.
If you tell the stories. So just make a list. You pick the one that you like the most, that you think you know the most about, that you like to share.
Yes.
You sit down and you write one paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
One paragraph.
Yes.
And while you're sitting, maybe you write two paragraphs, and then you stop.
Yes.
You wait a day or so, and you sit down again, and you write a couple of more paragraphs.
Yes.
If you can write two pages a week,
mm-hmm.
then you can write a book.
Yes.
That's about the average for me, two to three pages a week. And I do it a paragraph at a time. A story at a time.
Yes, and that's a great way to approach it. I mean, it was very therapeutic for me, and I've enjoyed it since. And just for you all out there that know me or didn't know that I have a book, it's called Beyond Demographics: The Truth About Diversity. It's out on Amazon, and Barnes & Noble's also taking orders on it. And I was told that indie publishers will never get into the big box stores. Well, that's not true either. So, you know, I the way you approached it, it was the way I had to approach it. I had to write when I felt like writing. I couldn't just force myself to sit down and write because it wasn't authentic for me. But the key, and what I hear both of us saying, is that we stuck with it. It was something, another talent that we had. So we went with it, and we followed the breadcrumbs and allowed that to help us to create that book. And I'm going to tell you, Bernie, I mean, right now, I think we got a couple people that have been trying to get in on the line. So I'm going to call out an area code real quick. If somebody wants to jump in while we got this segment on, I'm with Mr. Bernard Lee here with me visiting on the radio station and on the radio channel, the show Diversity Works on Blog Talk Radio. Area code 315, if you're out there and you would like to join us, by all means, knock on the door and we'll open it. If not, we're going to keep pushing. But area code 315, if you'd like to get in, or any other area code out there, if you'd like to get in and talk to Mr. Bernard Lee or myself or make any comments about the show, feel free to knock on the door of our producer, Mrs. Beverly Black, and she'll let you in, and you can get in on the conversation. So 315, if you're there, if you want to get in, we'll wait for a second. If not, we're going to push because we still have a lot of show left, and I want to make sure that, Bernie, you get a chance to explain to our listeners what they can do when we talk about using your talents, not only to better your organization, because if your name is not on the front of that building, there's no security in that. The only security is betting on you. So can you tell us a little bit about what made you have the confidence within yourself to write a book, to work in all of those different places and doing all the things that you've done? What are some of the things that help you get to that point?
Yes, I can. I'd had success at writing when I was younger, and that is helpful. I had done some technical writing at AT&T, and that's helpful. But I was always good at telling stories,
okay.
And I expect that a lot of our listeners are good at remembering stories and at telling stories. So here's what you can do. You can tell a story, and you can record it. And you can play it back. You can play it back, and you can write using that method.
Right.
It's your stories and your ideas that you can share that people want to hear once you put them down, once you've made the effort. But actually, you can recite. You can tell a story verbally,
mm-hmm.
and then have it recorded verbal to text, and you can write the story that way. But the idea is to tell a story. Now, you can't tell a good story unless you know what a story consists of.
Right.
You've got to have characters that will cause your reader to have an interest. You have to have a storyline. You have to have something that people can identify with that the character does or is doing or is attempting to do. And every story must have some intrigue. There must be some challenges. There must be some, not necessarily complete failure, but the story can't be total success. That's not a story. That's a fantasy.
Okay.
So a real story has challenges. A real story has ups and downs. And a real story pulls the reader in. So the reader becomes a part of the story.
Okay.
And so I was good at telling stories, and I used that particular gift that I had to help me write. And now, it helps if you read.
Okay.
It's very difficult to be a good writer, and it's actually very difficult to be an interesting person. If you never, ever sit down with yourself in a quiet place and read some things that others have written. For instance, I read memoirs by Trevor Noah. He's from South Africa. He wrote Born a Crime. I read his memoir. I've read Bad Boy by Walter Dean Myers, who wrote a lot of fictional novels.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned him. I purchased his book because he wrote a book telling authors how to write. It's a very short book, but I purchased it. I learned a lot from it. I like Easy Rollins Mysteries by Walter Mosley. I like mysteries by Sue Grafton. Mysteries have a set pattern. You start off with a mystery, with something you have to solve, and you work through the course of the story to solve it. So I learned storytelling from reading. And you can listen to books on books. You can listen to video of books that are recorded. So you can listen to a book. You don't have to actually sit down and read it. I listen if I'm traveling from one place to another and I'm going to be an hour or more in the car. I'll listen to a book. I'll listen to a book while I'm traveling. And that's one way I get through them. But reading is a key. In anything you want to do, in anything you want to become really good at, in a person that wants to be interesting, you must read. And I'm not just talking Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. All of those are great.
Yes.
But you want to read a little deeper than that. Okay. You want to know about the person who's creating the content. You want to know about the life of the person who's in the play of the movie. You don't want to just know the movie storyline. You want to know more. You want to go deeper. You want to know about the person who wrote the play, the person who became the director of the movie that wins an Oscar. Read deeper. Read deeper if you want to be those people.
There you go. And, you know, Bernie, as we sit here talking, and the time is just really blown by, and I could just sit here, you know, all night and listen to you because you're an intellectual. So that kind of stimulates my thinking and, you know, start to ask questions of, you know, what more can I explore of myself? And I can tell you in learning diversity, and I will say learning because it is much more than what people think it is. But when I learned diversity, the way I learned it was doing the things that you just talked about now. It was putting myself as close to someone else's experience as I possibly could so that I would develop empathy, not just sympathy. Sympathy is easy. That's a natural feeling that most of us have for our fellow human being. But empathy is something that has to be practiced. And by doing those things, reading all the time, by having conversations with different people from just all over the world, any opportunity I had to speak to someone who was different from me, which is everybody because I don't have a twin, it gave me the ability and the skill set to empathize with people. So that whenever I'm delivering a lecture, whenever I'm discussing diversity, whenever I'm teaching diversity, it helps me relate to the audience better because I can hit them from different angles. I can meet them where they are. And it sounds like you've done that with yourself and have allowed yourself to have a much bigger reach than you would if you would have just stayed isolated, like the story you talked about going to the math table instead of staying at the table with the athletes. That's the kind of diversity that I'm talking about, where I haven't heard you once mention the fact that your race or your ethnicity held you back from doing anything. Now, you and I both can agree, and I think we've discussed this a little bit, that yes, racism exists, discrimination exists. We know that. History tells us that. But we got to live, right? We still got to be here on this earth. We still live in America. So what are we going to do to overcome those things?
I think you ask a very good question. The answer for me is you see me, I see you. If you can focus on the other person and actually see them, actually hear them, actually listen to them, actually begin to understand them, then you can bridge that gap. And you have to do that at almost for every opportunity you want, you've got to sell yourself.
Yeah.
And the best way to do that is to understand what the person who's offering the opportunity wants.
Okay.
And you won't know that unless you study them, read about them, research them, and then when you're with them, you listen.
There you go.
You listen. So because of my military background, a military kid background, I learned to listen and find out what the new group of people that I was going to be with for the next 3 years, who they were, what they were about. And, for instance, when we moved to Germany, I was very anxious to get to know what German kids were all about. And I had a couple of opportunities to do that. One of the opportunities was ice skating. Now, you say, when would a kid like me learn to ice skate?
I didn't know brothers ice skated, man. I've never seen too many brothers on the ice, not on purpose anyway, but you got to explain it. Give me that experience.
There's not a lot of ice in Georgia. There's not a lot of ice in Texas. There's not a lot of ice in Oklahoma and Kansas. And those were the places we spent much of our time at. Well,
okay.
I had learned to roller skate. I learned to roller skate fairly well. So I figured, okay, roller skating will translate to ice skating, and it did. I was able to pick it up. But
Learning
the people was more important. I was on the ice. I was having a kid who took an interest in trying to help me learn how to, you know, stand up straight, how to get up when you fall, how to make a few turns. And then a group of local kids got out on the ice. They had hockey sticks. They had a hockey puck. And they began skating and playing, and then they spotted me. I had only had a couple of hours of lessons, but I listened to them. I watched them and I listened to them. There was a fellow named Dieter. I didn't know who Dieter was, but they kept saying Dieter, Dieter, trick, trick, Dieter, Dieter, trick, and this was their way of calling out the guy who they thought was the best player on the team. And I noted that Dieter would have the puck, he'd hit it to someone, and they'd yell, Dieter, Dieter, and then they'd hit it back. Well, what happened was they hit the puck to me. And if you're familiar with hockey, the person with the puck is really in trouble if they don't know what to do with it.
That's right.
So I had the puck. I didn't have the slightest idea what to do with it. They literally... I was creamed. I was bowled over. They took the puck from me, and they took off down the other end of the pond. I could have given up. I could have given up. I wanted to be a part of the group. I observed. I said, okay, I can do this. I can do this. The next time they came down to my end, they decided, okay, we're going to do the same thing again. We're going to hit the puck to him, and we can bowl him over and take it. And he hit the puck to me. You know what I did?
I took off, huh?
No. I had paid attention. I had looked. I'd watched to see what they did. I spotted Dieter when they hit the puck to me. I caught the puck. I swung. I hit the puck to Dieter. They looked at me like they couldn't believe it. The next thing I knew, they were all yelling, Dieter, Dieter, trick, Dieter, Dieter, trick. And I was skating along with them, and we went back and forth up and down the pond. I had figured out the game. The game was when the puck comes to you, you hit the puck back to the leader, or you get creamed.
You know, Bernie, I watched a little hockey, and I think there's a little bit more to it than that, but that's a good lesson for safety and how to keep yourself safe. And that, I have sympathy and empathy for you being in that situation, because I'm just having a visual of you being smashed by all these kids and you not knowing exactly what to do. But that will make you learn. That's why you're a quick learner now. You get smashed
absolutely.
One time, you pick it up quick, right?
Absolutely, you have to. You have to, and you can if you pay attention. You have to believe that you're going to be included.
Okay.
Because
all right.
You will be included if you learn the game.
Okay. And that's life.
You will be included if you learn the game.
Yes.
You will be excluded if you decide you're only going to play your own game.
There you go. Absolutely.
You don't need someone else to play your own game.
Right. Right.
So
there you go. That's great. I mean, that's what life is all about. You know, and I always say, hey, listen, if success is a house and you want to enter that house, I learned from a great burglar that a door only locks one way. But you can get inside of that door several ways. You can pick the lock. You can kick the door down. You can break the glass and unlock it. You can have somebody unlock it for you. You can get a key. If you want to get in bad enough and you want that success, you're going to figure out how to get in that house. But being
absolutely.
Out in the world, Bernie, like you, and having those experiences, what else I've learned is this. The caveat to that is this. if you pay attention enough, like you're talking about, and being observant to the game, you can build a house and put the doors anywhere you want to. Now you have all of the access, and you let people in and out of it. And that's what this show is about. That's what Diversity Works is all about, folks. And this is why I have guests on like Bernie, because they come with so much knowledge about life and about business and about success in the world. And that's truly what diversity is. We've been on the phone for an hour now on this show, and we've talked very little about discrimination or racism. What we talked about was progression. I am by no means saying that we should forget it. But those are things that when you're trying to succeed, you have to put them in the rearview mirror. You go back and revisit them when you need a recharge so that you don't go back and repeat the same mistakes over again. This is why I need you all to always join me on this show. The next show will be airing on March 27th, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern. Be here. We're always going to have enriched dialogue the way we've had it tonight. Bernie, you have been a fantastic guest on this show. The caliber is the same as it's always been. And if somebody wanted to get in touch with you or read your memoir, how could they get in touch with you and find your book that you have out there?
Okay, I have a website, www.BernardLeeJr.com, BernardLeeJr.com. If you go to the website, the books are on the website, the information about me is on the website, contact number, my email address, and all are on the website. You can put in my full name anywhere on Google, Bernard, N as in Nathaniel, Lee, J-R. You'll pull up four or five things about me and a half a dozen different ways that you can contact me.
Okay, good. And to contact me, for the listeners out there, you can reach me at Gary, G-A-R-Y, dot R Consulting at gmail.com. You can visit my website at www.RichardsonConsulting.net. You can reach me on an email through there. Check out my YouTube videos out there. I have two of them that's out there right now. Just type in the search, Gary Richardson, Wounded Warrior, and my other video that I have posted out there, posted just about a month ago, month and a half, Gary Richardson, How to Effectively Measure Your Diversity Efforts. Those two videos are out there. And, of course, the book that many of you have already bought and supported me on, Beyond Demographics, The Truth About Diversity, is out on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. We'll take your orders on it as well. I want to say to you all, once again, thank you all for joining us. You could have been anywhere, but you spent this time with me and my guest Bernard Lee on this show, Diversity Works. We love you to death. Painesville, once again, as we sign off, I want to say to you all, thank you for joining me and for giving me all of the support. Stay with me. We're going to have some new exciting things coming to you all in March. One little teaser that I gave you earlier, I have just purchased a home in West Palm Beach that I am going to be using for Airbnb. For those of you who all like to travel and you want to get down to a beautiful location, this is the spot. It's the view from the house. You can look right at the Intercoastal Waterway. I'll be sending you all some pictures to let you see that, and I'm going to kick off the beginning of my diversity training program. It's going to be a 3.5-day training program, and it's going to be held in West Palm Beach. And get this, here's the package. Not only do you get the 3.5 days of diversity training, you're going to get a certificate from me as a practitioner doing this business since 1999. You get a meal on me. I'm going to provide you a meal while you're there. And you get the lodging at the house in West Palm Beach, all in a package deal, and we're going to have some fun with it. The house is already being booked as we speak. In fact, I got a guest coming in next week, actually this week, this Friday, that's coming in for a week. So I'm going to send you all the pictures out and let you all know about that, folks. But this has been a fantastic show. Bernie, I want to say thank you for joining us. You've been great. Ladies and gentlemen, my spaceship is firing up. They're about to take me back to Planet Lovetron. The show is coming to an end. Join us once again on March 27th, 8 p.m. Be here with us, and we're going to have some more engaging dialogue the way we had tonight. I want to say to you all, good night and bless you all. Bernie, thank you. We shall see you
thank
all
you
soon.
Too, Gary. Yes, thank
good
you,
evening.
Gary.
Okay.